Ms. Logo Massini is Director of Risk and Environmental Policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Okay, we're a free market public policy group, and we believe in limited government and free enterprise is the best way to advance human well-being. Lots of people ask when I do these presentations where we get our funding, so I'll just start out with that. CEI is a charitable organization, so we depend on contributions from individuals, foundations, and corporations. It's all voluntary contributions. We don't take money from government because that's a taxpayer dollar. We don't think we should be taking that. But we don't operate on contract for anybody. Usually that's the question is who's paying for this project. We basically operate on our principles, and we pick our issues accordingly. Our activities include lots of media outreach. We do a lot of radio and television. This is a picture of our president, Fred Smith, being interviewed with for the Bill Moyers program. We do presentations like I'm doing here today. We testify on the Hill. We meet with members of Congress. We advocate our ideas and our points of view. And in some cases, we engage in litigation to try to provide balance from the lawyers on the other side of the issue. Why do we work on West Nile issues and pesticide issues in general? On this one, we believe that there are groups out there that are undermining the freedom for people to actually engage in activities to protect themselves from public health risks. And we also believe that these groups' main agenda is to attack technology and the freedom to use technologies that are part of the market process that we believe improve human well-being. So we also believe, and in this case I've been focusing a lot on misinformation and trying to correct the record, that markets operate best when there's good information. So there should always be an open debate, and there should be policy is not the result of science, but it should be informed by sound science. This issue in particular, pesticides and public health issues, we're very concerned because there are lives at stake. This is a quote from Dr. Donald Roberts of the Uniformed Services of the University of Health Sciences. He says, "The practices of environmental advocacy groups are seriously degrading public health capabilities in the United States. Our public health threats are real and growing." Dr. Roberts has worked a lot on the DDT and malaria issue. He's traveled around the world researching and treating malaria victims, researching the issue. And as others have noted during this conference, scientists generally don't like to be policy advocates. They don't want to be activists. They want to focus on coming to the truth over the scientific issue. And Dr. Roberts is among those who doesn't want to be involved, but he's felt compelled because there are groups out there that are engaging in activities that are so deadly that he has to become an advocate and an activist in his own way. So we started out working with him and a coalition of groups around the world on DDT issues. I tend to focus on the West Nile virus. This is the issue that brings it all home. Just to quickly go over the DDT issue, DDT was once hailed as this great public health achievement, and its discoverer earned the Nobel Peace Prize because he was credited with saving millions and millions of lives. It was something that we used to protect our troops during World War II. It was embedded in their uniforms, and it was used to douse concentration camp victims. It was very effective at a lot of things. It was viewed as this great cure for all of our public health problems related to insect-related diseases. There was a lot of success. Malaria was eradicated in parts of the world, and death rates had declined in other parts from tens of thousands of per year down to double digits annually. So there was a lot of success. That's not to say there weren't challenges. It's not to say there weren't mistakes. Andrew Spielman, a professor at Harvard who does infectious disease issues and mosquito issues in general, recently put out a book called Mosquito that he co-authored with Michael D'Antonio. And he basically notes lots of the benefits we got from DDT, but also the fact that insect resistance was beginning to become a problem. We used it excessively in some cases, and we were learning, but we made our mistakes along the way. But he advocates limited use now, And that's what we were advocating in the developing world, where it was sprayed on huts and just a very limited use where there's not widespread exposure and where resistance issues are kept to a minimum. Here in the United States, Rachel Carson brought to the fore the concern about DDT in public health. And there were, we used massive amounts of DDT, sprayed it in the environment, and there were trade-offs and there were problems. It did help eradicate disease, but there were concerns about wildlife, that it affected the bald eagle and reproduction of the bald eagle. So that, you know, that was a concern. It was eventually banned, not because of public health uses. There was a lot of politics involved, but EPA admitted that public health-wise, even though there were massive public exposures, the impact was not significant, but it was an issue for birds. So widespread use in the environment did pose challenges. But because the environmentalists took an extreme approach that since it, you know, it had some problems, that they wanted to get rid of it completely, and so it was banned. And there have been repercussions of that policy. For instance, malaria rates have skyrocketed in the places where they had gone down at the single digits. South Africa has recently gone back, but you can see here's some documentation from another Harvard researcher that cases rose. You know, they were in about 4,000 in 95, and they've gone up dramatically in 99. And he attributes this to the, you know, the reduction in the use of DDT. Now, when they use it in the developing world, it can be used, as I noted before, more as a repellent than as a something to eradicate the mosquito. And part of the eradicating the disease is keeping people from being exposed and breaking the transmission cycle. So what they do is they spray it on these huts. You know, they don't have screens, they don't have air conditioning, they don't have sealed houses. And so these mosquitoes feed at night primarily, when people are sleeping. Bed nets may be part of the solution, but people don't tend to use them consistently enough. They've got to be soaked in insecticides that may be even more toxic than DDT. So it's all about trade-offs, and limited use this way, actually, and Dr. Roberts has done some research showing that limited use keeps the mosquitoes from coming into the house. It doesn't necessarily have much of an impact in the environment. It just keeps them out of the house. It's basically like a screen for people who can't afford the type of screens that we have. So there are ways to use it, but there are a coalition of groups that are fighting it, saying that, you know, it should not be used at all. And there's even an international agreement trying to that will phase it out eventually. There are public health exemptions because public health community finally woke up and opposed complete ban immediately. But you can see the World Health Organization estimates, you know, millions of people getting sick every year, 1 to 2 million. Children dying every year from malaria, and a lot of this can be avoided. So environmentalists have taken the same type of strategies here at home, and now that we've had the West Nile virus, it's becoming an issue. Here are some of the claims that some of these groups are making, and I go through and analyze them and question whether or not their activities are impeding public health at home. Pesticides, here's one quote from one group in Massachusetts. A lot of local groups that are doing this. Pesticides sprayed in response to the West Nile virus endanger our health, put our kids at risk, and poison our environment. This is a more general claim that, you know, as we've used more chemicals, cancer rates allegedly are skyrocketing, and allegedly it's the cause of, related to chemical use, and this is an environmental working group that they say, you know, cancer rates have risen 1.2% a year. And, you know, better detection alone doesn't account for this. And so they're saying we need to get rid of a lot of these chemicals. The question is there really a great cause for alarm? As we've been using more and more chemicals, we are also living longer and longer. So there's some question to whether or not this is having a monumental impact, but we should look a little closer. Cancer rates. Are cancer rates increasing? Here's this Environmental Working Group quote. They've gone up 48% live longer. Your chances of cancer, since it's a disease of aging, increase. And they also often don't account for such things as the fact that there's a larger proportion of people, because of the baby boomer generation, you know, that are older. And that will make the rates look higher. The National Cancer Institute tries to account for those type of things, particularly the fact that there are a larger segment of people at older ages. And recently, they're finding that cancer rates have declined from 92 to 98. Not, you know, dramatic, but important that we're making progress. And if you, I have another study that I pulled together. I don't have their charts here because their data wasn't as easily accessible. I should contact them. But excluding smoking-related cancer, cancer rates have declined since 1950 overall. Now, this is National Cancer Institute data, cancer incidence for all sites. You can see that it did go up since 75, and it is starting to come down. The question is, what is causing the increase? This is actually very interesting. Prostate cancer, I expected to see more, you know, because since, you know, before 1975, you know, lung cancer has always been a key cause of cancer incidence increase. In the 80s, prostate cancer went up. And you can see there's other things that have come up and are slightly going down. But the National Cancer Institute does not point to pesticides or chemical use in general as the main cause or even as a significant cause. They do note that improved detection from prostate cancer, as you notice when the spike occurred, that is the point in time where they started finally doing a lot more testing and detecting prostate cancer. But they also note that that alone is not, you know, necessarily the only cause. Dietary factors, increased intake of animal fats, greater sexual activity and other sources. And the fact that people live longer does mean that the probability of all of us getting cancer is higher than it would have been in the past. They do note that occupational exposure to pesticides is a possibility. But they don't think that it is a particularly strong case, but it's not something they completely eliminated. But what we're talking about is public exposure, not occupational exposure, which is much higher. It is something that, you know, is studied and should be a concern. But they do not cite public exposures to low levels of pesticides in the environment as a key cause. But environmental groups are hyping it up as if that were the cause. Overall, cancer mortality, fortunately, thanks to the good work of the medical community, is declining. And so that's some of the good news. And here, cancer deaths by site. Again, you can see lung cancer. Fortunately, prostate deaths are going down. And you can see that lung cancer, largely smoking, is a huge contributor to that. Lung cancer is still a challenge, but it has come down a little bit. And as people quit smoking, they expect it to continue its downward trend. The thing that environmentalists cite most often is breast cancer. And they say that, you know, if you spray pesticides, more women are going to get breast cancer. In Long Island, New York, there have been elevated levels of breast cancer historically. And the question has always been, why, you know, is it that Long Island used more pesticides? There have been a lot of studies on this. Recently, they did the largest one, government-funded study, most comprehensive, and they still, and done by the researchers who have really been trying to make this case, and they couldn't find a link. But also, again, the National Cancer Institute notes that they have declined deaths and incidents during the past decade. Another thing that environmentalists say, since overall cancer trends are not as compelling to make their case, they've started looking at segments. And one, the big one they're saying is that our kids are all getting brain cancer, and therefore we shouldn't be spraying pesticides. But the National Cancer Institute, again, did a report on this, and they noted that it was better detection. That there are very few number of brain cancers among children every year. So if there's a couple more that are detected, it makes it look like there's this huge jump in brain cancer problems. But actually, we're doing better detection, and that's where they determined that was the most likely source. So it's not fair to say that there's this cancer epidemic of brain cancer, and it's because we're spraying pesticides. Fortunately, we overall, childhood cancer, thanks to better treatment, is coming down. Here's another thing that environmentalists use. A couple came to my sister's house, a woman, when they started the West Nile issue, started in the 1999, and said to her, well, you know, environmental factors cause a majority of cancer. We need to minimize it. We shouldn't be spraying cancer. Here is another claim where they another group says, you know, environmental factors, and they identify them, pesticides, PCB, and radiation, are key causes of cancer. Well, the best research on this is a study done by Richard Dahl and Richard Pito, and is still cited as the authoritative research by all the authoritative cancer researchers around the world. Richard Dahl is one of the scientists that was relentant in his research to prove that that tobacco was a carcinogen when nobody believed it was. He was one of the first to discover that and to prove that fact. He is, you know, world-renowned. This is their assessment of causes of cancer, pollution 2%, and you can see the dietary factors, and that does not include residue on food that would be in the 2%, tobacco, infectious diseases. These are the general causes. Environmental pollution is not, sure, environmental factors are the causes of cancer. Pollution is only one of environmental factors. Environmentalists would like you to believe that all of them are related to chemical use. Here's an example to show you, something's missing from my slide here, of how extreme these groups can become on these issues. This is a sign that was posted. This is unfortunate. I'll read them. Some of the quotes are, I don't know how they disappeared. But this is a sign that was posted in Ohio where they were debating whether or not to spray. It was found by somebody in the Department of Public Health. And maybe they're just making fun of the whole debate, but it is indicative of how crazy it has become. And some of the other quotes that I have that I pulled together is one, and this is in 1999. They were all downplaying it in 1999. It's much more difficult today because it's become more serious. But one group, Citizens Campaign for the Environment, a person has a much better chance at winning the lottery than getting the West Nile virus. These diseases, and this is what one of the girls said to my sister. These diseases, this is quoted in their literature, the New York Green Party, these diseases only kill old people and people whose health is already compromised or poor. As if that's some kind of comfort. My sister said, well, you know, that's my mother and my sister, thank you very much. And West Nile isn't serious because it only killed 7 people in 1999. 7. That was 1999. It's much higher now. But the point is, you know, they're trying to downplay it. Usually, one part per billion of a chemical theoretically could kill, you know, they always talk about theoretical deaths, and that's completely unacceptable, 1 in a million. And here we have people that are getting sick, and they are downplaying it. They like to say, well, more people die of the flu, and therefore West Nile is not serious. Well, that's true, but the flu is a serious concern, and it is something we should be addressing. And mosquito infections historically have been catastrophic. And so because these things are very unpredictable, when a new virus enters, public health officials need to take it seriously, whether it's going to turn into something dramatic or not. West Nile's exceeded all expectations. The largest West Nile outbreaks in the past were around the 500 cases area. Now we had last year more than almost 10,000 cases in the United States. So it's out of proportion, and it's a lot more than expected. Oh, they're going to phase in. I don't know how that happened. So the question comes down, well, what's worse? Is it the West Nile or spraying? Certainly everything carries risk, and spraying should be very judicious. And in fact, I know that I've been talking with a lot of the vector control people. They don't want to resort to spraying. They want to control the mosquito at the larval stage. Environmentalists are fighting that as well. I'm working on a research paper on that topic, so it's not covered extensively in here, but they're fighting it at every level. And so it gets to the point where if you can't control the larvae, you're going to be spraying more often. But the question comes, which is worse, spraying? And here's two perspectives. Environmentalists are saying it's, you know, the spraying is worse than the disease, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and I know a lot of people criticize them, but the people working on the West Nile, we've been critical as well for other things, but the people working in the West Nile, I found that they've been doing some good research, and I find their efforts on this to be good. He's saying that, you know, this is a serious issue, and we do need to, you know, find ways to prevent it. Here's some data that was put out by CDC. They They searched for cases of pesticide-related illnesses to find out if there were people getting sick from the spraying. They looked at newspaper articles. They called around the country to, you know, pesticide reporting, you know, where they report these incidents. And they found that there were zero deaths, two cases that were confirmed, 25 probable, 106 possible spray illnesses. This is from 1999 to 2002. It doesn't include last year or West Nile. If you included it, that West Nile case would go off the page because there were close to 10,000. But you can see if you're comparing which is worse, it looks like West Nile is a more serious problem. The two cases, one of them was serious. It was a woman with emphysema, something that we do need to take very seriously. People who have breathing problems need to take precautions when they're spraying. She had fans in her windows that were sucking the air in, and the spray truck came by. It brought the pesticides in. She had breathing aggravations, and that could be very serious. She went to the hospital and fortunately recovered. I can understand that and how dangerous those type of things could be. My mother has emphysema, and she went into New York City, was in a hotel that had an air freshener, shut her lungs down. She had to go to the hospital. You have to take important precautions, and it's something very serious. But if my mother were to get stung by a West Nile virus-carrying mosquito, it would kill her, for certain. I mean, she cannot get the flu. When she gets a cold, it's a big issue for us. So those individuals need to take precautions, but you got to look at the big picture. You know, of that 4,000 people, about 3,000 got encephalitis-type illnesses, which is very, very serious. This is a very painful disease. I had somebody contact me from one of the associations for people who have encephalitis and was very happy to see somebody who was speaking on this topic because it is very, very painful and very serious. And a lot of them, you know, there's a number that actually have a polio-like result at the end. They end up having permanent damage. So if you're comparing one over the other, you know, you got to balance the risks, and that's all we're saying. One of the things that the Audubon Society was claiming in New York is that spraying is just, it's going to kill all the birds. And this is something that personally, and these pictures were taken by my sister, we are both very much bird lovers, and she's, you know, she was concerned about this as well. You know, they said that there were 80,000 birds that were collected and studied for the West Nile virus, and most of them were dying from pesticides. Steve Malloy he's a science journalist. He got hold of some of the data, a smaller segment of it, and discovered that what they were saying were birds dying from environmental toxins were actually dying from botulism. And a lot of them were dying from West Nile. There were 219 pesticide-related cases in the data that he collected from New York State. 30 were intentional poisonings, 100 were illegal intentional poisonings, and 27 from lawn care products.
What's the difference between intentional poisoning and illegal?
Well, you can kill, there are certain birds you can kill, like starlings, and that are considered pest birds that are invasive. So those were intentional. Let me make sure if I got this. Unfortunately, we don't have all the information on the 80,000 birds that were studied. In fact, I'm not sure that they were all studied. There's no peer-reviewed. I called the U.S. Geological Survey to find out what they knew about it because they do a lot of monitoring. They've done it for 25 years. They said, this is not peer-reviewed. The data is not available. I tried to get the information from the official in New York State, and he wouldn't send it to me. He gave it to the Audubon Society, allegedly, but he wouldn't provide it. He's not making these claims publicly. He might hint at it, but he's let them make the claims. So there's something going on here. So, and they told me, the U.S. Geological Service said, I'm sure that, they said it's likely that a lot of this is from natural toxins, not from the spraying.
You know, I might add that we know.
We should wait. Please wait.
Okay. I'll try to, I was going to try to leave some time.
Okay.
This is U.S. Geological Survey data. This is not going to catch the periodic bird that dies from lawn pesticides, but it does capture the mass die-offs that are discovered by the federal government. And here you see that natural causes are the biggest causes. This doesn't include the West Nile virus data because they didn't have it for 25 years, but that would be significant. Lead from bullets and organophosphates, much lower. organophosphates being the category of pesticides. The state of Michigan does similar collections, and they have in their reports very few. They find very few birds that are killed from pesticides. It's not a big factor for them. So what are the conclusions? The conclusions is that Audubon is making conclusions that they really can't with the data that is available. And certainly if that data was available, I would love to see it, and I would think it'd be important to inform the debate, and it would make me think more about using these products. But it's just not there. Evidence is lacking of widespread bird mortality from pesticides, and the residential impact from lawn products is not clear. But it is clear that West Nile virus is taking a toll on birds, and particularly birds that are in low population. It has been killing birds of prey, owls in particular. This is from the Bird Watchers Digest. They collected some information that you know, there could be as many as 400,000 that are being killed based on the samples that they've collected. And birds have died, endangered species have died at zoos, horses also, another area, prize racehorse went down from West Nile virus. Lots of horses are being hit bad. So it is having an impact on that industry. But the U.S. Geological Survey is trying to research this, and they have an initiative to follow it because they consider it to be very serious. Another area that the environmentalists have claimed is that the lobsters off of Long Island are dying out because of pesticide spray that might, that accidentally went in the waterways. And the lobster industry has managed to get a very large sum payment from the federal government on the basis that this is a disaster. Lots of money has been dispersed for research, and there's a lot of very good research going on. The guys that are researching this issue are doing, in my opinion, a good job. But these groups are making all these claims. The Lobster Initiative, all the research that was funded by the federal government, has shown that there were other factors that were more likely. There was a researcher at the University of Connecticut who first discovered a pathogen in the lobsters that was the likely cause of the disease. They also note, Long Island is the farthest southern environment where these lobsters breed and live. They generally prefer the colder waters, so this is sort of a borderline area for them anyway. So if they're hit with other stresses, it's going to be hard. They had unusually warm weather, waters, low oxygen levels, extra chemicals that are not conducive for their development. And one researcher from Stony Brook concluded that climate is the killer in this case. So the question comes down to, all right, well, it was probably this pathogen coupled with these other environmental factors that are natural, mostly. And so the only question is has it reduced their immunity so that when these other things, the spraying, hit them extra hard? And there was research showing in the lab where they put the lobsters in tanks and very, very low levels of the pesticide that the lobsters were being affected, okay, even after 96 hours in laboratory conditions. Yet, nonetheless, things to be noted is why it's impact, even that impact is doubtful, is the lobster diet began before the spraying. So the lobster started dying before they started spraying. So if you're looking for cause and effect, that's something that raises a lot of questions. Laboratory tests are not the same as the waterways. Lobsters go down to the bottom of the water. Pesticide lands on the surface. It degrades within a couple days. The lobsters are in the bottom. The chances of it reaching them is questionable. And studies showed that, again, it dissipated very quickly. And this is the researcher who's contending that the pesticides were, impeded immunity and has been arguing for this. Even he notes that they looked for it in the water and they couldn't find it. They looked for it in the lobsters and they couldn't find it. Here's something of interest. I was wondering how badly this has impacted the lobster industry, this die-off, whether or not it's caused by pesticides. And you can see there's some impact in the end there of 2000 and 1999 and 2001. It looks like there's a little recovery, but overall, nationally, lobster industry is doing very well. And in fact, historically, the last couple of decades, it's done amazingly well. In New York, you see a more dramatic chart. Here in New York, you see all of a sudden, and this raises another issue that others have raised as a possible contributor to the lobster die-out, there is an incredible increase in lobster take in the 90s. And there's been some suggestions that they were overfishing the lobsters, and that has contributed to the problem. They are still, you know, if you look at historically, it's a dramatic drop in 99, 2000, but it's, take out the 90s, it's not that more, not that different from prior decades. It's still higher than a lot of them. Another thing that the environmentalists are doing that I think have even a real serious impact is they're telling people that DEET, and they've been trying to get it banned, and there was a limited ban in New York State for some period of time, but they're trying to get it banned, and they continue saying that this insect repellent is causing problems for children, and it shouldn't be used at all, even according to label directions, and this is one group that's trying to get it banned. The question becomes, you know, it's, again, a risk issue. Some researchers published an article in the Canadian Medical Journal, and they looked at all the cases. There were a couple dozen cases of kids who had seizures when they were exposed to a large amount of DEET. But they looked at it, and there's no necessary cause and effect. Given that a certain percentage of children have seizures, the question is, are these related to DEET, or these seizures would have happened? And we really, they say that, you know, you don't have a proven link. The important thing is that you use a product according to label directions. You don't soak the kid. It says how much you're supposed to use, and these are limited, you know, limited amounts. So it's a matter of managing risks. Do you want your kid to be exposed to the mosquitoes? There aren't that many cases for many, many years of DEET being used. The New England Journal of Medicine did a study and found it was one of the safest and most effective approach insect repellents, and they have other things here that they've tested. You can see that DEET lasts much, much longer than other products. And if you're concerned about exposure to, you know, not just mosquitoes, but to other insect-related diseases, including Lyme disease, which is a big issue, probably a bigger issue in a lot of ways, you want to do something to protect yourself. And for more information, I guess my presentation is a little shorter than others, but leaves opportunity for question and answer. I did a study on this. It's available online at the address below. There's also that link on our front page, the Pesticides and Public Health page. It has all our DDT work and other things for those people who are interested. And this is our address and email. So if anybody has questions, we can jump into it.
Yeah, very nice presentation. We know in Hawaii that some very endangered birds are disappearing because of alien malaria. And when spraying is done in those areas, those bird populations tend to be protected. I read an article once that said that when there was extensive DDT spraying in the United States, many bird populations increased, because they were also protected from mosquito-borne diseases. So those points are rarely brought out, and I just sort of wanted to put them in the record. I understand in World War I, more soldiers died of typhus than of bullet wounds. And no American soldier died of typhus in World War II for DDT reasons.
Thanks.
I wonder if you've looked at some of the summaries that J. Gordon Edwards has done. Some of them were posted on our website about a DDT for the birds. And he reviewed quite extensively the evidence that purportedly that DDT was damaging birds. Some of it was frankly fabricated. A lot of it was misinterpreted. Like you can cause the birds to have thin eggshells by not feeding them calcium. Okay, so they had a control group and a DDT group. But it so happens that the DDT group not only ate DDT, but it didn't get any calcium, and not surprisingly, they couldn't make thick shells for their eggs. Some of the bird counts were fabricated at the places where the pelicans were supposedly disappeared. Actually, they did not do so. And so the whole environmental case against DDT was not credible to begin with, although it probably is not a good idea to do vast spraying in agriculture, like to get rid of the boll weevil and so on, mm-hmm. just because of DDT resistance. But even the purported effect, it does exist in the environment for a time, but you can measure the rate of degradation in seawater, for example, and it's really pretty rapid.
Right. Yeah, there's a debate amongst even the people on our side working on this issue, what the impact was on birds. And I've heard both sides. As you noted, we're not going to go back to it for resistance reasons. We don't need to use the widespread use of DDT to protect human life. So why not use it in limited quantities? We're not going to have any of those issues. So those are good points, and those are things I'll definitely take a look at.
Another little point of information, Steve Malloy, whom you used, has posted on his website, junkscience.com, a rather extensive compilation that he did largely based on the work of Dr. Gordon Edwards and Dr. Orion just mentioned.
Okay, great. Thanks.
You did speak about the genetically produced DDT in corn and other plants.
Right, biotech. We have another person who does extensive research on biotech, and it is something that we consider very important to help feed the people in the developing world to make, and also to reduce pesticide use, you know, around the world and produce more food for more people.
So what is your group's opinion on the subject?
We would like to see the technology develop and the freedom for people to use it. And we would prefer that sound science, rather than fear, inform that debate. And Greg Conko put it recently, he's done a number of publications with Henry Miller at the Hoover Institution, and they are putting out a book called The Frankenfood Myth. So it's something you might want to take a look at.
Just like to add, I have been contributing to your organization for quite a while and like it very much. And you can mention to Fred Smith that you met the guy who called him from Hawaii on occasion.
Okay, great. Thanks.